The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for an audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, and I'm John Feddersen reading this week's issue, dated January 12th of 2024. That's right, 24. Set those checkbooks ahead 1 year. We fade our smooth theme music down, and we have quite a thick folder of stories today, and I'd better get to them. And here we go. Our first article we will definitely trim for purposes of time, and you can always go to IndieWeek.com and find the completed articles, including links which are included to them, and I can't read them all to you. But first, from the Durham City Council, they announced 4 finalists for that Ward 3 council seat that was left vacant when Leonardo Williams moved to the mayor's chair. And the 4 finalists are as follows. Amanda Borer is the administrative director for neuroscience at Duke Health, holds degrees from Ohio State and UNC Chapel Hill, and has volunteered on several healthcare-related boards in Durham. Chasten Swain is a law and policy advisor for the state of North Carolina now. He holds degrees from Appalachian State, Pennsylvania State, and UNC's law school. He currently sits on several environment-focused boards in Durham. Chelsea Cook, an attorney at Legal Aid, North Carolina. She holds degrees from UNC and Stanford. She's previously volunteered to support voter and civic engagement. And Sheila Huggins is an attorney at her own firm. She holds degrees from NC State and UNC Chapel Hill. She also ran for an at-large city council seat this year, dropping out after coming in 5th in the October primary. At the time, she indicated she was interested in Ward 3 if Williams won his election and left it vacant. So those are the names and their basic qualifications. The article also includes a paragraph from each on why they would like to serve on the council, and it's provided from the applicants' questionnaires. Indy has not verified any of the info. And that's enough, and you can actually go to IndieWeek.com and see more about each candidate if you wish. Next, in Chapel Hill, this is an examination a little closer at regional mayors who have recently stepped into the new mayoral jobs, and Jess Anderson took the CHOP job of mayor of Chapel Hill with a promise to fight a trio of crises threatening the town. She said in her first, Anderson told a town hall audience in her first speech as mayor last December, municipalities across the country are facing very real challenges, including a climate crisis, a housing crisis, and an affordability crisis. Despite all the special things about Chapel Hill, we are not immune. Anderson won her election with the support of former Mayor Pam Heminger, who had served as the town's mayor since 2015. During her tenure, Heminger focused on righting the town's imbalanced tax base, skewed by the presence of a large public university, by championing business, including the Wegmans near the Durham border and 2 new wet labs downtown. She also pushed for more affordable housing. The town reported that in 2023, Chapel Hill doubled its previous record for the most number of affordable units approved in a single year. Council newcomers Melissa McCulloch, Theodore Nollert, and Elizabeth Sharp took their oaths alongside the incumbent mayor, Amy Ryan, who won a second term. Those 4 members will serve until 2027, while the seats of council members Camille Berry, Paris Miller-Fouché, Adam Searing, and Karen Stegman will be up for election in 2025. While the season saw its share of disagreements between candidates, the council is united by an optimism about the future of the town and a desire to serve as a model for other municipalities facing this nationwide shortage of affordable housing. That optimism was reflected in Anderson's rhetoric as she framed the crisis as an exciting new opportunity to implement the town's complete community framework, developed in 2022 and adopted into town plans through this year as a cornerstone of her vision. It's a guide that, through changes like amendments to the Land Use Management Ordinance, that's LUMO, aims to balance the town's needs for housing, transit, real estate, and other categories in order to provide structure to the council's future decisions. In June, the council approved changes to the LUMO to allow for the construction of a greater variety of housing types. This year, the council will have to figure out how to transform its plans from ink on paper to brick and mortar. Anderson told Indy in November following the election, it's about getting those greenways started. It's about getting that denser middle-income housing out of the ground. It's about making sure we're continuing to build partnerships with our key local partners. The town's new affordable housing plan and investment strategy, approved earlier this year by the council, affirmed that, quote, considerable progress has been made to address affordable housing in Chapel Hill. But there is still a lot of work to be done, as the same plan warned against complacency, arguing, quote, the town should focus on sustaining and scaling up its housing programs over the next 5 years. Through votes and comments, the last council indicated a willingness to approve most housing projects, with some notable exceptions. Council members were practically incredulous at a proposal to replace the aging King's Arms apartments on Ephesus Church Road with a 212-unit luxury housing development. Stegman told the developer about the proposal, coming without even a real proposal for consideration is really a problem for me. That would have decreased the overall number of affordable units on that site. Later in the year, the council drew another line as it denied a proposal to squeeze a 12-story luxury condo tower onto a 1/3-acre lot on East Rosemary Street in near the historic district. Several council members expressed they liked the proposed building itself. They just had issues with the location. They indicated they would be open to approving a smaller building on that site. And with that pro-growth attitude, the council has indicated a re-imaging of the identity of the college town. Stegman said at a meeting, Chapel Hill is not a small town. We are a growing small city with a housing shortage. The affordable housing crisis, as it disproportionately affects people of color, is inseparable from the small southern town's legacy of enslaving, disenfranchising, and discriminating against its black residents. The site of some solutions to this wicked problem may be the Green Tract, a roughly 160-acre stretch of land jointly owned by Orange County, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. In the last decade, task forces and resolutions have considered possible uses and developments of the Green Tract. About 60 acres are owned solely by the county as a headwaters preserve. In 2021, the county and town governments approved a plan to mark 22 acres for a nature preserve, 66 for development, and some 16 for public school and public recreation. Officials have studied the Green Tract as a step in remediating the harm inflicted by the landfill dug in the 1970s in the largely black Rogers Eubanks neighborhood. At the time, Orange County and Chapel Hill officials promised residents that they would receive basic utilities, streetlights, and sidewalks in return for locating the landfill in their community. Officials also promised to eventually turn the landfill into a park. In 2024, it's still a landfill with toxins leaking into the ground, water, and air. The Green Tract and the landfill are also tied to the story of the St. Paul Village, a 350-unit development by a nonprofit associated with St. Paul AME, Chapel Hill's oldest black church. construction will start this year on the village, which will eventually offer 90 affordable units and 100 for seniors, as well as a community center and space for retail. The nonprofit members have pitched the development as a gateway to the Green Tract because of its location. While the land has been stuck in the limbo of government, an already convoluted process compounded by joint ownership between two towns and a county, the St. Paul Village development may bring the attention needed to move forward with projects on the Green Tract, all with the goal of addressing the affordable housing crisis and making Chapel Hill, as Anderson said at that December meeting, even better now and for future generations. She concluded, "Meeting this moment will require us to collectively embrace change, not simply for change's sake, but because change is inevitable if we truly want to continue to live our values while the world changes around us." And also in Orange County Schools have chosen the former Durham Public School Assistant Superintendent to lead them in a troubled time for the district. Following the departure of four-year Superintendent Monique Felder last year, Danielle Jones, who currently does serve as Assistant Superintendent for Durham Public Schools, will start in Orange County on February the 1st. Jones was selected by the Orange County Board of Election, the Board of Education, from a pool of 26 candidates from across the country, according to a news release. Jones said after she was sworn in on Tuesday, "This is a tremendous honor, and I want to express my sincere appreciation to Orange County Board for the trust and confidence they have placed in me." She began her career in education as a middle school teacher in Youngsville, later moving to the Wake County Public Schools, and then Franklin County, where she served as principal and assistant principal. At DPS, she worked as principal supervisor and coach before becoming assistant superintendent. Jones says, "I have a business degree in management. I was teaching at a daycare and tutoring after school, and I just fell in love with it. So that's sort of how I got my start. I started as a math teacher." In Jones's time at DPS, she oversaw 12 middle schools, which consistently made impressive academic gains over time, said the news release. Each school saw increased proficiency level last year, and in terms of academic growth, that's how much students learn over time, six were in the top 20% of schools in the state. Jones says she's particularly proud of the work she did growing instructional leaders by working with principals and assistants, helping them provide support to teachers, and making sure that filters down to the student level, she adds. But while Jones's record appears to bode well for Orange County schools, some parents, teachers, and community members remain dissatisfied over former Superintendent Felder's abrupt departure. Felder left the position in August after the school board failed to extend her contract. Orange County schools had made major gains under Felder. In 2022, 10 of the district's 12 schools exceeded the state's expectations for academic growth, a higher percentage than any other district in the state, according to North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. Felder also had a strong record of expanding student equality. She wrote in a March statement to the Indy, "In spite of this progress, some will always exploit times of uncertainty to advance their own limited or destructive agendas." Her words hinted at controversy over inclusive school policies that has grown in recent years as lines are drawn between liberal Hillsborough residents and conservative Republicans who live in other parts of the county. The political conflict has been playing out in school board meetings since 2016 and peaked during the COVID pandemic. In 22, the local election resulted in moderates taking back a majority on the school board, leading to greater scrutiny of schools and administrators. Now Orange County is once again faced with transitioning in a new superintendent, a worrying prospect given the history of turnover on the job. In an October survey of community members and staff, over 800 respondents said they wanted a superintendent that, quote, models high standards of integrity, communicates well with people of all races and socioeconomic status, and is willing to listen to input. Experience as a teacher and with building, maintaining, and managing schools was also important to people in the school district. In a brief statement after being sworn in, Jones thanked Orange County teachers and staff and pledged to, quote, continue fostering an environment of trust, mutual respect, and academic excellence. She added she's committed to promoting open communication and collaboration with parents to ensure a safe learning environment. But equity and inclusion are also on the minds of community members. In a letter to the school board from the Northern Orange NAACP, President Matt Hughes emphasized the need for the district to continue its commitment to equity, opportunity, and student performance. He wrote, "We believe the next superintendent needs to be a visionary leader who's committed to equity and student growth." He added that education officers should also work to close the opportunity gap for students of color and English language learners, as well as support teachers with salary supplements and take care of classified staff such as bus drivers. Helping the district meet its challenges, he wrote, includes continuing the progress that had been made under the previous administration. The Northern Orange NAACP is committed to helping our local district meet its challenges, and fundamentally that includes continuing the progress that has been made. At this time, radical shifts in policy and focus will not serve the student of this district or the community well. We need a superintendent that's already committed to the district's successful path on so many of these initiatives. Jones declined to comment on specific Orange policies or issues until she officially steps into her role February the 1st, saying she still has some work to do getting to know the school district. Generally, however, she says her goals are, quote, to make sure we're supporting teachers, administrators, and that we're meeting the individual needs of students, every child. We'll continue in Chapel Hill, Orange County, and nearby locations with a long article about coal ash. The black dirt on the steep slope of an overgrown knoll of trash overlooking the Bolin Creek Greenway in Chapel Hill is, in fact, not dirt. It's coal ash, fully exposed to the elements. On this windy winter morning, it's hard to know if ash particles are hitchhiking on the breeze, but to stand downwind elicits a sense of unease. Coal ash could increase a person's cancer risk significantly more than previously estimated, according to a recent EPA report, raising questions about the safety of places where ash has been used as a structural fill. This is especially true when the ash is visible, like that mound along Bolin Creek. Like in Mooresville, where ash has escaped a sinkhole in a commercial parking lot and protruded through crumbling asphalt at Lake Norman High School. Like in Weldon, where state inspectors found swaths of exposed ash at an abandoned sawmill. At least 9 million tons of coal ash have been legally used as fill at a minimum of 72 locations in North Carolina, state records show. However, because the state didn't require documentation of structural fill sites until 1994, the number is likely far higher. Nationwide, the American Coal Ash Association estimates that a total of 180 million tons of the material have been used in fill projects in the United States since 1980. Material was commonly used as a cheap way to undergird parking lots, buildings, runways, and roadbeds, reinforced berms at rifle ranges, and even enhanced soil on farm fields. It originated at coal-fired power plants, including Duke Energy, Cogentrix, Roanoke Valley, and even smaller facilities that served textile mills and universities. As long as the ash is adequately shielded with a barrier, like concrete, asphalt, or thick layers of dirt, it's unlikely people would be exposed to the contaminants in soil, the EPA wrote. When those contaminants reach groundwater or surface water, they can travel or enter the drinking water supply, presenting additional hazards. But when that concrete barrier is exposed, the arsenic and radiation can be released. Late last year, the EPA published a draft risk assessment of coal ash residuals. Those are known as CCRs. The agency found that even low levels of arsenic and gamma radiation, which are present in CCRs, drive this increased cancer risk. Although the EPA limited its scope of the risk assessment to fill used on land at electric power plants, its conclusions can be applied to similar sites elsewhere, and it doesn't take much exposed ash to be hazardous. The EPA found that there is an elevated cancer risk even when ash composes only 1 to 2% of the soil mixture. When more ash is present, as little as 8% of the soil mixture, then cancer risks are high enough to trigger EPA regulations. The cancer potency of arsenic is 35 times higher than previously acknowledged, according to a previous EPA risk assessment. Depending on the level of exposure, people can develop other health problems unrelated to cancer. High blood levels of arsenic and cadmium have been linked to a greater risk of heart disease and stroke. Earth Justice, a national environmental law firm, and 150 public interest groups sent a letter last month to EPA asking the agency to ban the use of coal ash in structural fill. The letter reads, "These findings are alarming because coal ash used as fill is often not diluted nor covered with soil to shield its radioactivity." State DEQ quality spokeswoman Melanie Foote said the agency is reviewing the draft assessment and proposed rule changes. Duke Energy disagreed with the EPA report. Spokesman Bill Norton said the findings in the draft risk assessment are not reflective of real-world conditions. Rather, EPA made unreasonable assumptions in the absence of robust scientific data. The extremely small amount of radiation from coal ash is similar to the background radiation we experience every day from natural soils. In North Carolina, ash is rarely used as fill anymore because of public concerns about its safety, particularly after Duke Energy's massive coal ash spill into the Dan River in 2014. Norton said the utility no longer provides ash for structural fill in North Carolina, which state records confirm. However, millions of tons of ash remain, some of it securely encapsulated, and some of it not. Since 1982, the Chapel Hill Police Department on Martin Luther King Boulevard sat atop 46,000 tons of ash that had originated at UNC Chapel Hill power plant. Over time, the slopes eroded and in 2013 released ash and contaminated soil and groundwater adjacent to Bolin Creek. The town removed the exposed ash and installed a super silt fence to prevent material from entering the adjacent greenway. However, exposed ash is still visible on the slopes. When the police department announced it would move, town officials originally planned to build affordable housing on the site, but subsequently retreated because of public outcry. The latest proposal includes a variety of uses, a municipal service center, office, retail, bus infrastructure, and public green space. Yet as early as 1994, state environmental regulators advised against using coal ash as fill under public green spaces. Referring to an unrelated site, DEQ wrote at the time, "It does not agree on including areas of high intense public use like parks, golf courses, and ball fields for using structural fills." Now the EPA draft risk assessment could further alter the cleanup plans. Chapel Hill Town Manager Chris Blue told Newsline that town officials are gathering information about the EPA's recent assessment. "We will continue to work with EPA and DEQ to meet their requirements for any additional remediation or redevelopment of the property." Nick Torrey is an attorney with Southern Environmental Law Center. The SELC is representing Friends of Bolin Creek, which opposed building residences atop the ash. Torrey said, "I think they need to go back to the drawing board and recalculate the risk. The cleanup will require doing a lot more. The eroding slope needs to go, and all areas with unacceptable health risks need to be removed." In addition to parking lots, structural fill has been used for other purposes in North Carolina, state records show. Below are examples of other places where the material was used, the amount in tons, the source of ash, and the purpose of the fill. I will edit the next part of this list. Basically, these are all multiple tens of thousands of tons, except for one location, and I'll just name them. Cherry Point Marine Corps Base, Kilpatrick Farms in Duplin County, Southport Gymnasium in Brunswick County, that's 400 tons, O.N. Vaughn Property, Halifax County, the interchange of I-95 and NC-125, got 3,000 tons. Jake Alexander Boulevard Extension, Rowan County, nearly 12,000 tons. And our eternal reminder, going to IndyWeek.com to read annotated, complete printings of the EPA's findings and risk assessments, an annotated version to help in the 85 pages or so of documentation. Anyway, to make it easier to understand, they say we've converted that figure to tons instead of cubic yards. And you can go to Newsline's reporting to view a complete list of known structural fill sites. Well, to continue, the town has hired contractors to sample soil, groundwater, and Bolin Creek to order to learn about the nature and extent of contamination. Soil and groundwater contained levels of 10 chemicals, including arsenic, barium, cadmium, cobalt, and manganese, above the state standards, public records show. And again, there is a link to those public records. Contractors did not test for radium, which is radioactive and known to be present in coal ash. When radium decays, it releases gamma radiation. Exposure to either form can cause cancer. Foote told Newsline that in 2019, Chapel Hill Police Station was tested for the presence of radon gas, also a byproduct of radium. It was not detected in 3 of 5 samples. In the remaining 2, concentrations were well below EPA action levels. As a result, DEQ did not require further sampling for the radium. However, elevated levels of this was present in the ash itself, found independent researchers. Avner Van Gosh, a distinguished professor of environmental science at Duke, and several colleagues analyzed the chemical composition of 8 ash samples from the 828 site. The samples were gathered from the soil surface to 4 feet deep. They found not only high levels of arsenic in shallow soils, but also radium-226 and radium-228 at levels 2 to 4 times higher than background. EPA concluded, depending on the thickness of the cover, gamma rays can pass through soil and other materials to reach the ground surface. where residents are exposed directly to ionizing radiation. People can breathe the ash particles, which contain arsenic. The ash may become intermingled with surface soils, the EPA wrote, where residents are exposed through incidental ingestion of soil and dust present outdoors and tracked into the home. The town has enrolled the 828 site, as it's locally known, in the state's brownfields program. A brownfields site is an area that would be difficult to redevelop because of its contamination. Under a brownfields agreement, the state requires a developer to clean up the site for certain uses. A cleanup level for residential development would be more stringent than one for an industrial building. In return, the developer is not liable for the previous contamination and can more easily obtain financing for a project. Over the past year, Chapel Hill officials have been negotiating the terms of the Brownfields Agreement with DEQ. A draft agreement is to be scheduled to be released this winter for a 30-day public comment period before it's finalized. Before EPA and DEQ began regulating coal ash, fill locations were not tracked. Only in 1994 did rules go into effect, and they were weak. Although fill was required to have 18 inches of cover soil, there was no mandate that the fill areas had to be inspected to verify the condition of the sites. Under the Coal Ash Management Act of 2014, it is still legal in North Carolina to use ash as structural fill, albeit with more requirements for utilities to report their production and disposal. Since the law passed, DEQ has permitted no small fill sites, and only two sites larger than 8,000 tons per acre. Brookhaven in Chatham County contains 7.3 million tons of ash in lined cells on 145 acres. The facility's owner has since closed the facility and no longer accepts ash from Duke Energy. Groundwater testing near Brookhaven indicated that levels of barium, chloride, chromium, cobalt, and vanadium exceeded state standards. The Colon Mine in Lee County, also owned by Charah, C-H-A-R-A-H, never received ash, the result of a protracted court settlement. Coal combustion byproducts can legally be used as soil additives or amendments under the authority of the State Agriculture Department. However, Brandon Herring, an Agriculture Department spokesman, said the Plant Industry Division has not approved any application to register coal ash for those uses. There are at least two other structural fill sites in North Carolina where ash is currently exposed, state records show. More than 769,000 tons from Roanoke Valley Energy was used as a fill at a now-abandoned sawmill on Mulberry Street in Weldon. The ash was ostensibly to be used as base material for an access road, which was never built, and a lumber drying yard. The 25-acre property is less than a quarter mile from private homes and near wetlands and Chokayot Creek, which feeds the Roanoke River. In 2019, 2021, and most recently 6 months ago, DEQ inspectors found swaths of exposed ash on the unkempt property. Inspectors wrote last July, there are numerous areas of the structural fill showing signs of exposed coal ash. Vegetation was too overgrown to safely inspect those areas. The property owner, Job Womack, had been cited by the state three times from 2001 to 2010 for disposing ash outside the approved area, for disposing of household and construction waste and other debris on top of the ash, and for allowing the site to erode, which released ash when it rained. Womack could not be reached at two numbers listed in public documents. In 2010, DEQ records show the state issued a compliance order that carried a penalty. The case was never resolved. One of the most problematic structural fill sites in the county is the Tire Masters property on Plaza Drive in Mooresville. Because of an improperly installed pipe and culvert system, a sinkhole formed in the parking lot, releasing coal ash into a tributary of Lake Norman. A legal impasse about who's responsible for repairing the damage, the property owners or Duke Energy, has halted work at the site, allowing the ash to travel unabated. Tire Masters is one of 20 documented structural fill sites in Iredell County, most of them clustered near Mooresville and Duke Energy's coal-fired Marshall steam plant. This is the same area where North Carolina health officials identified statistically higher incidences of papillary thyroid cancer, 2 to 3 times greater than state average. Radiation is a main risk factor for this type of cancer, followed by age. It's largely a disease of middle-aged, affecting primarily women over 50. But many of the thyroid cancer cases in Iredell County were reported among teenage girls. Although thyroid cancer rates are rising nationwide, it is unusual for young women to develop it. State health officials have not linked thyroid cancer cases in Iredell to the ash. Yet many residents, such as Susan Wind, whose daughter developed thyroid cancer when she was 14, attribute the disease's prevalence to the tons of coal ash used as structural fill. Some of the deposits on farm fields as landscaping weren't required to be documented, but several longtime residents remember when it was common. Wind has since moved her family to Florida, where her daughter, now in her early 20s, continues to battle the disease. Along with Earth Justice, Wind, and many North Carolina residents like Bobby Jones of Goldsboro and Caroline Armijo of Bellows Creek have petitioned EPA to enact strong federal rules on the disposal of coal ash, rules that would apply to states. Earth Justice wrote, "An action to remedy these hazardous sites and prevent further dangerous use of toxic coal ash is needed because EPA's current regulation is grossly inadequate. For larger volumes, the lack of enforceable safeguards and oversight is equally disastrous." Well, I thought we would move away from Chapel Hill, but we won't. We're going to talk about Dame's Chicken and Waffles. Why? Because every Wednesday afternoon at 4:30, the sound of children laughing at Michael Newell's jokes, singing along to Zha, S-Z-A, and sharing what they want to be when they grow up, resounds throughout Dame's Chicken and Waffles in Chapel Hill. As one of this year's after-school activities, the children of the Community Youth Program, CYP, spend these afternoons learning culinary, customer service, and management skills under the guidance of Newell, co-owner of Dame's Chicken and Waffles, and an alumnus of UNC Chapel Hill. Dame's is a casual eatery popular with students that serves comfort food, including almost world-famous chicken and waffle combination and smears of flavored butter. The local chain currently has 3 other locations in Greensboro, Cary, and Durham. The Chapel Hill location opened in 2019. Newell said one afternoon after serving the CYP scholars their weekly fix of fingers, French fries, and burgers, "I thought this partnership was a really neat idea, and I was really excited about it. Of course, we're happy to work with the kids, especially when you can have a partnership where you can do something that's impacting other lives while still doing what we do, which is serve people good food." CYP is a community outreach initiative helping K-12 students from low-income families and underrepresented communities in Orange County schools learn interpersonal and literacy skills. It has been sponsored by the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History since back in 1993. LaRonda Manigault Bryant, CYP supervisor and director of Sonia Haynes Stone Center, says, "Kids' families have historically and economically been below the poverty level. That's been the case 90% to 95% of the time. Part of the work put into Communiversity is to get young people exposed to various hands-on experiences. Genevieve Campbell, a senior manager and child welfare and education expert at strategic consulting company ICF, has been involved with CYP for 3 years. She sought out CYP in 2020 for her eldest seventh-grade daughter, Charlize Charlie Campbell, who needed more than what she was getting at just a basic school setting. She says Charlie needed a community space where she could kind of explore, be uplifted, and explore her gifts and talents in a way that might not have been fostered or, at the time, appreciated. Campbell describes partnerships like CYP's with DAMES as absolutely critical, adding that CYP has more empowerment than it does some kind of deficit narrative when it comes to creating programs for underrepresented children. Other organizations CYP has collaborated with, including 10 Mothers Farm, a small farm located in Cedar Grove, and an NC State program called the Engineering Place, among others. Campbell says DAMES allows the children to understand aspects of business and hospitality. Fourth grade student Quinn Campbell, Genevieve Campbell's second child, says that she and her sister Charlie loved the food part at the restaurant, alongside the opportunity to see the volunteers and friends. During the first few weeks at DAMES, Quinn learned how to navigate the complicated buttons on the cash register, use the waffle maker, and scoop mac and cheese into containers. She also met a manager for the very first time. Quinn says, "At first I was scared of meeting the manager because of the mean things you hear on TikTok, but they aren't like Karen's." He wasn't mean at all. Most CYP activities take place at United Methodist Church on Franklin Street. Going to an outside location and seeing someone who looks like the students succeed in business is a beautiful thing, Margot Bryan says. That exposure element becomes really important, she goes on. It gives the kids another way of thinking about access to opportunities that they would not or might not necessarily have on a daily basis. Now, the CYP's after-school programs are led and organized by UNC undergrad students, volunteering from the Bonner Leadership Program, which is made up of student scholars who are passionate about community services. Timothy Little, UNC sophomore and program volunteer, says, "I've always wanted to do something with kids. I thought working like this would be a perfect opportunity to not only volunteer but inspire other kids to go out into the community and help others be the best they can be." Little found out about CYT through Sierra Flynn Nesbitt, another sophomore volunteer. The DAMES partnership was the brainchild of Flynn Nesbitt and her high school English teacher in Cary during the summer of this year, of 2023, excuse me. Flynn Nesbitt says, "My high school teacher is Michael's sister, and I really like DAMES. During the summer, I thought about what we could do this year to make it a little more different and more connected to the community around us." Flynn Nesbitt contacted Newell, and they got to work organizing workshops and other plans for the students. To Flynn Nesbitt, an across-the-street partnership at DAMES just made sense. Her high school was across the street from the DAMES location in Cary, she says, and she and her friends would eat there often after school. Now, she and the other CYP volunteers take the students across the street from the church to DAMES in Chapel Hill. The partnership runs through April, but Manigold Bryant says that she hopes it will continue farther. Either way, Newell says he will always be grateful for the opportunity as a business owner to work with CYP. Quote, "To have these moments with the students is one of the more rewarding parts of being a business owner. It's not always like that every day. Sometimes people are mad about this or that, or just the doldrums of owning a business can be kind of overwhelming. So it's nice to always work with young people and kids to see them grow, learn, and be engaged." Okay, and now we can head over to Durham, if we weren't already there, about a Durham league of their own. Game day atmosphere is electric. Bleachers lined with fans. Music blares through speakers, hyping up players as they go through their warm-up routines. Diehard fans can watch highlight reels and check team stats on Instagram. No, this isn't the NBA or WNBA. This is a game in the Durham League, an upstart adult recreational basketball league founded in 2016 by Robin Jackson, the league's commissioner. The first five seasons were women only. Since 2021, Jackson has expanded it to include a men's league, a 35-plus years old league, and a 50-plus league. Nowadays, some league players aren't old enough to legally drink alcohol. Others are old enough, they're starting to get mailers from AARP. The league has 225 players in total. Jackson, 38, is a Michigan native, a 2008 graduate of Indiana Tech, where she played college basketball. She moved to Durham in 2012 after visiting her cousin who worked at Duke. Jackson says, I flew back to Michigan after a visit in November and there was a snowstorm. And I was like, yeah, this is not working. So I packed up all the stuff I could fit in my car and moved to Durham. Finding pickup games and leagues for women in Durham proved challenging, and Jackson often traveled to Raleigh or Cary to compete. Other women in the area expressed similar frustrations. Seeing an opportunity to support her peers and continue playing basketball, Jackson started the Durham League. Almost immediately, it attracted high-level competition, with the players coming in from cities like Fayetteville, Charlotte, and Winston-Salem. Many of them had also played college basketball, and they were looking for an outlet to maintain their skills. Selena Castillo, a league player, says, I wasn't a 6'2 point guard who can dunk, so I'm not going to quite cut it in the WNBA, but I want to play still. I'm still good, and I still love and respect the game, and I want to improve. Castillo is the director of external affairs for the Duke women's basketball program. Before moving to Durham in 2017, she ran her own league for years in Tampa Bay, Florida, where former collegiate and professional women's basketball players found opportunities to continue playing competitively, even after their days in the spotlight were over. There, starting a league was about providing a competitive outlet, not only for others, but also for herself. She says, selfishly, I wanted a place to keep playing. She had been a high-level hooper in her own right. She set the all-time steals record at Emory University during her four-year career. But opportunities for competition at that level are limited for women's players if you don't make the jump to the WNBA or overseas professional leagues. Castillo offered to share resources with Jackson and joined the league as a player. Her team, the Wolfpack, named after the mascot of NC State, where many of her teammates previously attended school, are three-time champions of the Durham League. She says she begrudgingly played on that team and wore a red shirt, adding that as a Duke employee, wearing the red and white was better than the alternative light blue option associated with Chapel Hill. In 2021, the Durham League expanded. After advertising the Women's League on social media, Jackson began getting requests from men in the area who said there was a dearth of adult basketball opportunities in Durham. Seeing another opening, she began recruiting players. I put a flyer together, Jackson says. When I was out and about, if I saw somebody that looked like they played basketball, I'd tell them, I'm trying to start a men's league. That summer, the first men's season launched with six teams. James Jimmy French, a forward with the size and shooting range to give any opponent trouble, started creating content to promote games for the team he created, 3XP, all over his Facebook page, emulating shows like ESPN Sports Center by producing mixtapes, compilations of a baller's best moves, and player interviews. He even created a logo and custom jersey so his team would stand out amongst the competition. French, a Durham native, played basketball at Jordan High School. He says the Durham League brought folks out of retirement, whom he used to play against in high school, but who had not done organized sports in years. He says now, we're all playing together and fellowshipping again. People feel rejuvenated. The online additional promotion from French and others boosted the league's notoriety. By the third season of the men's league, a total of 11 teams had signed up to participate. Jackson says, I started talking to Jimmy, and he told me, this is cool. The city needs this. There's nothing for us to do. When I looked further into it, all the guys kind of felt the same way. Loneliness in America has become a growing problem, particularly since the onset of the pandemic. Recent studies reporting about half of U.S. adults have experienced measurable levels of loneliness. The problem is particularly acute among young men, with 1 in 7 men between the ages of 15 and 24 saying they have no close friends. When it comes to available forms of connection and entertainment, bar hopping or playing video games are the likeliest to crack the top of the list for younger generations. But that's why opportunities like Durham League are so important. And for players and fans alike, the gym isn't just a place to compete or support friends and family. It's a sanctuary. Athletes and coaches often use words like fraternity and brotherhood to describe sports organizations. Team sports reveal a lot about someone's personality and teach us important life skills like leadership, cooperation, and resilience. Deep, lifelong relationships between teammates and opponents are often fostered through the trials of heated competition. My own relationships are a testament to this. I've played competitive team basketball for most of my life and have played Durham League teams for several seasons. Years ago, I quickly developed a connection with another player, Raj. During pickup runs at the cage at American Tobacco campus, purely off the strength of our on-court chemistry, he was a shifty point guard who knew exactly where to pass the ball, and I was a volume shooter who thrived on the receiving end. In 2021, Raj invited me to be a groomsman in his wedding. An incredible honor. It all started with a love for basketball. Kyla Shea Menendez, deputy director at Durham Sports Commission and a former college basketball player at Western Carolina, investing in recreational sports builds community-wide health and wellness. Sports are a great unifier. There's physical activity. There's social interaction. It's an outlet that allows people an opportunity to do something that brings them joy and a sense of belonging in a safe environment. As part of the city's economic development plan, it created the Durham Sports Commission. In the past, the commission has recruited a number of high-profile sporting events like the National Collegiate Fencing Championships and the NAIA Football National Champion. But the Sports Commission is also looking for ways to reinvest in Durham residents. Basketball is one way. Menendez says, we know that not every athlete is going to go on and play college. These athletes are going to matriculate. They're going to be the people who fill these adult leagues. So we need to make sure they have the resources to excel in sports and in life and start talking about next steps. The city has seen increasing alignment between residents and council members about the need to invest in better facilities and more recreational programming. During a recent discussion about ShotSpotter, Mayor Leonardo Williams reiterated the need for more programs to support young people, black men in particular, as an alternative method to reducing crime. Williams said, I hear a lot of the commentary about why not ShotSpotter. I actually agree with a lot of it. I said the same thing. We need more food security programs. We need better health care. We need after-school programs. Our kids are too bored in this city. We have to have more robust recreational program across the entire city. Things are trending in a positive direction. The city of Durham has made significant improvements to their facilities in recent years. Many of the parks now include essential features like restrooms and water fountains, and a handful of the basketball courts now have outdoor lighting. In 2022, the Durham Sports Commission established the One Team, One Durham Fund, a privately managed fund that helps offset the costs of sports participations for parents and organizations that may lack the means. And in June, the city received an updated proposal from Discover Durham and the Durham Sports Commission to build a giant sports complex that would support up to 30 indoor and outdoor sports. Williams supports the idea conceptually, but says finding the money and the over 60 acres needed to build the complex will be tricky. Quote, "We can only find that kind of land in the outskirts of the city." More funding and a permanent home to host games would help Jackson continue managing the league, she says, which she does on top of her regular job. The Durham League has created an opportunity for Jackson to foster relationships between young adults in Durham, some of whom are at risk of falling through the cracks. Jackson says they're all at the age where they could be getting into trouble, but they're coming to their games and staying after the games, so I know where they are. I check on them all the time on Instagram, and if I don't hear from them, and they appreciate that. It's turned me into me doing it more for the community than anything. I might not be able to finish my last little snippet here, but North Carolina is getting a Buc-ee's. We've been reading about this controversy about this giant gas station for quite a while. Mebane City Council members voted to approve this plan for the mega convenience store and filling station at the end of a marathon meeting Monday night. The Mebane Buc-ee's will break the record for the world's largest gas station. There was a years-long battle between Buc-ee's opponents, who in 2021 successfully fought to prevent the company from setting up shop at a nearby site. Environmental and traffic concerns were presented. Buc-ee's representatives at these meetings spent much of their presentation addressing concerns about traffic clogs, stormwater runoff, harm to downtown small business, and the harm to sacred indigenous sites. My music comes and tells me I must stop talking about Buc-ee's and its 100 gas pumps for now. This whole broadcast is available on adultncreadingservice.org after the initial broadcast on Friday. And John Federson is now going to say farewell to listeners of Indie Week, and we'll be back with our next issue. Bye-bye.